What's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Bama Beat Podcast, a podcast brought to you by Wickles Pickles and Home Field Apparel. I am Brett Hudson, and I am joined by Clint Lamb. Clint, what's going on, man? How's it going?
It's going pretty good, brother. How you doing today?
I'm good. I know we would both be better if we were wrapped up in the warm coziness of a Home Field Apparel sweatshirt or hoodie. Go to homefieldapparel.com to learn more about the 100-plus schools they have in their catalog. It is unique logos, word marks, other insignias. They go through yearbook archives back to like the 1900s of your school to find logos and things like that that you've never seen on T-shirts, sweatshirts, and hoodies before. And they're printed on incredibly comfortable stuff. I already own a T-shirt. I'm going to own one more once they ship it to me. People who are very online in the college football Twitter community will know of the sad UConn Husky. It's been kind of made into a meme the last few years. They put it on a baseball T-shirt that I recently bought the other day on 30% off, and I'll tell you how to do that in a second. But it's super comfortable. The wife and I are getting a couple of sweatshirts from Home Field Apparel as well. So, again, at homefieldapparel.com, they have Alabama stuff. They have Auburn stuff. I imagine we have fans of both schools listening this week, considering the Iron Bowl is this week. Missouri, Indiana, Michigan, big schools like that. But then small schools like Wayne State and Indiana State and Slippery Rock and the Colorado School of Mines. So I think we all have family members who we know very little about them as people. Like, we know very few of their personality traits, and we know that one of them is they're a Baylor grad, or they went to Colorado State, or they're a, I don't know, I'm trying to think of another home field school. They're a Pitt fan. And you're constantly buying them. Homefieldapparel.com is going to give you stuff that you can't get anywhere else. So you're not getting repetitive with the gifts year over year over year. And from now through Cyber Monday, which I think is November 30th, you can use the promo code BFBAMABEAT, BF as in Black Friday, Bama Beat as in the name of this podcast, to get 30% off your order. It's done that way to give yourself the best chance to get it in time for Christmas. So homefieldapparel.com for all of your licensed collegiate apparel needs. Use the promo code BFBAMABEAT to get 30% off your purchase. I would imagine Kentucky would love to take 30% of Bama's point total away, so that game wasn't nearly as embarrassing as it was.
But what's wild is that they still would have covered the spread.
Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, 30% would be 20 points, roughly 21 points would be 42-3, and they were a 30.5-point favorite, so they would have still covered by over a touchdown, which is
Lord.
The wild thing about this game is that by the end of the first quarter, I was sitting there thinking to myself, this is playing out about how I thought it would, which was Alabama, after the long layoff, would be pretty rusty. Now, I wasn't guaranteeing that, but I was – you know, I talked last week about how I definitely thought that it was possible that they could come out rusty. What is wild about that is not only did they come out rusty and didn't look really great to start the game, and I think at the end of the first quarter it was like 7-3. Over the course of the last three quarters, they scored 56 points, which is incredible. And they more than doubled the point spread despite the fact that they started rusty. I'll tell you right now, there is no point spread that is safe when this Alabama offense is on. And it wasn't on to the same degree that it normally is, but it was on enough. What were some of your initial thoughts of the game?
Yeah, see, I think you hit the nail on the head there. And it kind of goes back to the profile that I've been kind of ascribing to this team for a few weeks now, which is they're a shootout team. Like, they have an offense where they can show up anywhere against any opponent and look at you and say, dude, we're about to hang 40 on you. There's nothing you can do about that. We're going to hang 40 on you, and you have to find a way to deal with that. And Kentucky clearly could not. And I think doing it in that environment says something because, again, Kentucky had one of the best defenses in the SEC. And I had someone tweet at me early in Kentucky week when I wrote something to that effect, and I don't know exactly how much snark was intended. But the tweet was, didn't you say the same thing about Georgia? And I was like, yeah, they're both two of the best defenses in the SEC. Getting torched by Bama doesn't mean you're not one of the best defenses in the SEC. The best defenses in the SEC and the nation can get torched by this Alabama offense at the drop of a hat. So this Bama team is a shootout team. And if you don't have an offense that can look them in the eye and go stride for stride with them, you don't have much of a chance, because Georgia's tried, Mississippi State has tried, Kentucky has tried. None of them were able to slow down Alabama's offense to any significant degree. The closest anybody came was Mississippi State holding Alabama to 34 offensive points. There was that pick six that got them up to 41 in that game. But, I mean, even then, in a different offensive environment, which people are kind of slowly but surely starting to come around to, where your standards for defensive excellence are changing, even in that environment, you don't look at 34 points with a smile on your face. So that's what this team is. They're going to do what they did to Kentucky. And I'm not saying they're going to win every game by 60 points, but that thing where the offense hits the stride and the opposing offense blinks and they just pull away over the span of maybe three consecutive possessions, Bama's going to do that until they meet an offense that can watch Bama score three straight times and then come back with three straight scores. And again, we're going to get into Iron Bowl preview in the next episode later in the week, but be it Auburn, Arkansas, if they're able to reschedule the LSU game, I just don't know that you're going to see that for the rest of the regular season. If Florida's offense is good, but is it nationally elite on the scale of Alabama's? I think there's a case to be made that it's not. So Bama may not see that until the college football playoff.
Here's the thing. Let me tell you how the score really got out of hand. And it's kind of obvious, but the score was already out of hand. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I think it was like 42-3, but they start pulling starters, including, you know, Najee Harris and Mac Jones. And you have the backups come in, the Bryce Youngs of the world, the Jace McClellans, the Roydell Williams, these true freshmen, and they continue to pour it on offensively. This was the most complete performance. Now, granted, did everybody play their best game? No, I don't think Mac Jones played necessarily his best game. He had a couple of throws that were incredible, but I don't think that this was the most outstanding performance that he's done, whether it be statistically, which is obvious, but including some of the stuff. You know, he had a couple of underthrows. The second one was intercepted. The one before that, which I think he got bailed out by a pass interference call. But, you know, it was not his best performance, but he still looked really good. But these younger guys coming in and continuing to be able to, you know, score points. And it wasn't like, you know, they did have that drive with Bryce Young. And I think we've officially hit that point in the season where Nick Saban and company are wanting to take, you know, with Bryce Young, sort of the same approach they did with Tua Tagovailoa, where even though they're up really, they don't want him just going in the game and turning around and handing the ball off every snap. They want to actually get him working within the offense, slinging the ball around a little bit, getting comfortable. And what I felt like we saw was Bryce Young look as comfortable as he has looked since, you know, getting to Tuscaloosa. Now, we didn't see all the scrimmages and practices, and that might have been showing up in practice. But as far as what we've been able to see in a live game situation, this was the best that Bryce Young has looked. And he only, attempted two passes, and he completed both of them for 53 yards and a touchdown. But both pass attempts were very impressive, what you see from him. And you had to be encouraged by what you was getting from the second team offensive line as far as moving guys in the run game. The running backs that were coming in looked excellent. That's how you ended up getting such a lopsided score. This wasn't, Nick Saban trying to make a statement to anybody or, you know, you have certain programs that will leave their starters in until they've scored 60 plus or 70 in a certain game. This was, you know, Alabama had gotten that comfortable 42-3 lead, and they decided to start pulling guys and just, but at the same time, it's a great opportunity to still work your offense and get some of those young guys, not just random, you know, meaningless reps. It was a chance for them to get live game reps that could actually help them down the road. And so that is what was very encouraging. That's exactly what you want if you're Nick Saban and the rest of that coaching staff, is to have your team in a position to be able to do that. And they executed, you know, everything very effectively. So you have to give them credit for that. But this was just a great performance. But here's the thing, and I wanted to get you a little bit, but I've seen a lot of people, not a lot of people, but enough people talking about how much improved statistically Alabama's defense has looked in the last, you know, is it, I think 14 quarters. And when to me, when I went back and I wanted to be fair here, when you actually look at the offenses that they've played, Kentucky sitting outside the top 100, sitting at 106 in scoring offense, Mississippi State, number 116, Tennessee, number 109, at number 109, and then Georgia sitting there at number 60. And for a half, Alabama's defense actually struggled with Georgia's offense, but that second half where they didn't allow any points and really took control of the game, that was nice to see, but they're still sitting well outside the top 50. So for anybody, some people took it the wrong way when I tweeted that out, because I wanted to point out, you know, that I feel like some people have gone too far one way when it comes to Pete Golding, and they've put too much of the blame on him. He gets blamed for literally everything that goes wrong. He should be fired. And when those kind of things happen, I want to reel people back in and bring them kind of back to reality. I know that it's easy to make scapegoat, but on the flip side of that, with the way that Alabama has been playing defensively, I think it's more so, not saying that the defense is not improved, I just think it's more of a product of types and styles of offense that they've been playing. And so for everybody saying that Alabama's defense is getting elite status and they're playing like that, and they're now in the top 10 or top 5 in certain defense categories, I'll reel those people back in and say, okay, you know, with what we're going to be seeing, kind of like you said, Florida's offense is really good, really, really good. And there's actually several who are coming up. When you start thinking about offenses that they could potentially play, let's kind of go over it. Florida right now has the number 8 offense in the country, scoring offense. When you start looking at some of these teams that they'll potentially be going against in the college football playoff, BYU sitting at number 4, Clemson at number 6, Ohio State at number 7, Cincinnati at 14, Oregon 19, Notre Dame at 20. There are others, but I just wanted to kind of go back through and look at some of the scoring offenses that Alabama could end up playing down the line and try to compare that to all these offenses that are ranked outside the top 100. Huge statistical difference. And, you know, that's because the overall talent offensively of these other teams and the way they can attack you as far as a defense is just very different. So what are some of your thoughts on, you know, the seemingly improved Alabama defense?
Everything you're saying there in terms of judging Alabama's defense based on the quality of offense they're playing and the style of offenses they're playing sounds like what I've been saying for probably 3 or 4 weeks now. Like you mentioned, with the scoring offense numbers not looking fondly upon Alabama's recent opponents, I'm a yards per play guy. I just think that's a better statistic to measure offenses for reasons we can get into another day. Kentucky, Tennessee, and Mississippi State, 3 of those opponents that we're mentioning, they are 3 of the bottom 4 in the SEC in yards per play. The other one is Vanderbilt. So think about all of the jokes and all the jabs that we as an SEC football community have made at Vandy for how bad they are. They're 0-7, right? Vandy is averaging 4.96 yards per play. Tennessee is 4.98. Mississippi State is 4.71. So again, think about all the jabs and all the jokes we've been throwing at Vandy for how bad they are. Tennessee is comparable offensively, and Mississippi State is worse. So put that into context. when it comes to Alabama's defense and the opponents they've been facing lately and thus the performance they're in. That being said, not all is lost, because I do want to go back to what I was saying after the Mississippi State game, which was, again, you can't really take a ton from that based on how Mississippi State runs their offense. That air raid doesn't really translate to some of the more difficult challenges that this defense will have to face later in the season, and apply that to the talent of player at Mississippi State. Fine. Not what Bama's going to face later on in the season, including this week in the Iron Bowl. It's hard to judge the entire defense and its overall progression based on those things. And you could say the same thing for Tennessee, Kentucky, and others. But there was one aspect in that Mississippi State game that I thought did matter, that was discernible improvement that you could ride with going forward, which was the open field tackling. I thought the open field tackling was better against Mississippi State, and that would translate to the future. I did think there was something else in this Kentucky game that you could kind of say the same thing for, which was playing better defense over the course of the game and adjusting to things that are happening in the game. Frankly, those are things that Alabama did not have in the first 3 weeks of the season. They did not have that against Missouri, against Texas A&M, against Ole Miss. Just didn't have that in the toolbox. Kentucky, they kind of did their thing for the first three or four possessions, right? They were controlling the clock. They were effective in the possession. They were getting themselves in field goal range. That's what they wanted, right? That's what their game plan was. And then Alabama got more comfortable with that. They got more comfortable defending some of those run concepts that they haven't really seen a ton of from their previous opponents. And they just locked all of that down. So that is a quality this Alabama defense showed against Kentucky that it had not shown in almost all of the games prior to it. So I agree with you that it's still too early to say for sure that this Alabama defense is working its way or is near its overall potential, just based on the talent that it has at its disposal and how good it probably should be with that talent. But there are little bits and pieces here and there that are improving each time they step out on the field. And you wonder if those things show up against better opponents like Auburn this week, like Florida in the SEC championship game and in the playoff. You wonder if this defense could eventually reach that potential that you, I, and a bunch of others had pegged for it when the season started.
I completely agree with that. There are signs that things are starting to improve. And what I do like about this run that they've had is the fact that they have, gotten a lot of confidence. They've all these guys that needed to get, significant experience, guys that were stepping into starting roles, guys like, Christian Harris, who needed to continue to get game reps. You're talking about Dylan Moses coming back from the injury. We'll get to him a little bit later, but you're talking about him continuing to get back in the groove of things. You're talking about the defensive line and kind of new faces and the familiar faces and kind of just finding the right combination of things. I think that Alabama is extremely deep. Now, when you look statistically, and granted, it's mostly, I wouldn't say mostly, but some of the lack of sack production, because sack production will only tell you so much. A lot of people take it as the gospel, and I do think that it's an important statistic, but I think things like QB pressures and QB hits and QB hurries, all those things matter. There was, I think it was like 5 or 6 QB hurries. There was some QB hits involved. There was only 2 sacks, one coming from Christian Harris and the other coming from Christopher Allen. And Christopher Allen leads the team in sacks with 3 through 7 games. I mean, the team as a whole only has 11 sacks. Now, some of that has to do with the way that they're not really being asked to get after the quarterback in certain situations. They're expected to kind of keep guys contained depending on the quarterback they're playing and get their hands in passing lanes. And they've done that in certain games, particularly Georgia, Mississippi State a little bit. And so that they've done what they've been asked to do from that aspect. But at a certain point, with some of the quarterbacks they're going to start playing, it can't just be getting your hands up and passing lanes necessarily. It's got to be getting, you know, putting pressure on them. If you want to beat Kyle Trask and that Florida offense, you're going to have to put pressure on Kyle Trask. And so that's something that I would like to see more improvement on. But there are aspects as far as the tackling efficiency, you know, the rotation that they've been able to get as far as getting more and more guys reps. I'm hoping, you know, for their sake that they're able to start translating that to keep the quality of defensive play up when they start playing these better offenses. But it's just like, you know, I mean, if the thing about Alabama's offense and the reason that you can sit there and say that it's legit is the defenses they've been going against, you know, with Mississippi State having a pretty good defense, Kentucky, Georgia supposedly having a pretty elite defense. Now, granted, they got did not look great against Mississippi State, but, you know, that's more, I don't know, that's a topic for a different day. Point being, they've played some pretty good defenses, good enough defenses where you can sit there and say, okay, the fact that this offense is still having the level of success against those defenses, that tells you that this offense is legitimate. I can't take away the same thing with the defense, and so it's just a matter of, you know, you would hope that there's improvement. It looks like there's been plenty of signs of improvement, but until you actually see them step on the field and have some you know, opposing offenses throwing some wrenches at them and trying to do things to put a lot of strain on them, I just don't feel like Kentucky or Mississippi State or Tennessee, none of the, especially those three, did absolutely nothing to try to confuse or complicate Alabama's defense or cause them any sort of issues. They, in a lot of ways, did Alabama's defense's job for them, is the way that it kind of came off, especially Mississippi State with, you know, zero running the football, and which wasn't unexpected. But point being, I just there's still some that needs to be proven. But at this point, it's like I've said in a lot of situations with a lot of other guys, they're doing as much as you could possibly ask of them, you know, and you got to give them credit for that. It's not like they're going out there against these. I mean, now, granted, there was some concerns a little bit. I thought Kentucky, despite the fact that statistically they didn't put up a ton of yardage on the ground, I thought run fits were still kind of an issue against Kentucky. And that is something that could end up being a problem later on. The good part about it is you got a team like Florida that doesn't really like to run the football. That kind of plays well into what Alabama does well or has been doing well. But, you know, if you take on a Clemson, Travis Etienne or ATN, however you say it, he's going to, you know, he's going to be a huge part of that game plan. You're talking about going against Notre Dame. You know, they want to take as much pressure off of Ian Book as possible. That offense is built around that big, strong offensive line and that run game. And I understand that Notre Dame's gotten blown out every time they've stepped on the field in the college football playoff. But this is the makeup of a team that could cause Alabama problems if they were to play them at any point in the college football playoff. So it's things like that that I would still like to continue to see improvement on. But you've got to give them credit for what they have been able to do, which has been, you know, show improvement and do whatever they can to at least look like a very improved defense.
So we have one more note on the defense, on one player specifically. Someone who's garnered a pretty good bit of attention from Alabama fans. We'll be discussing him and wrapping up our thoughts on the offensive display from the Kentucky game. We'll do that after the break. You're listening to the Bama Beat Podcast.
You know, life today is kind of a lot. We're always forced to be on. But every now and then, it's important to just stop, crack open a Mountain Cold Coors Light, and chill out. So when you choose to turn off, choose the one beer that's literally made to chill, Coors Light. Coors Light is brewed with a three-step cold process. It's cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. The mountains on Coors Light cold-activated bottles and cans turn blue when chilled to perfection. When your game is on this weekend, or any game for that matter, make sure your refrigerator is stocked up with the one beer that's made to chill, Coors Light. When life has got you on the go, 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 take a minute, relax, and enjoy a cold Coors Light. You can even have Coors Light delivered to your door by going to get.coorslight.com. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And we're back on the Bama Beat Podcast, again brought to you by Wickles Pickles and Home Field Apparel. Surely y'all know about Wickles Pickles by now. Family recipe made right here in the state of Alabama, 90 years in the making. Pickles, relishes, okras, every pickle-related product you can think of, they offer it. Go to wicklespickles.com to learn more about all of their products. You can find them on the pickle aisle of your local store. Wickles Pickles, let's get wicked. So, Clint, you and I got a tweet from someone I presume is a listener of the podcast. He doesn't have his name or attached to his profile or anything like that, but he's got a picture of the 18th hole at St. Andrews as his cover photo. So he and I are cool. But anyway, he and I'm sure other people noticed that Dylan Moses was not credited with a tackle in the Kentucky game, which seems kind of mind-blowing, right? That a run-based offense like Kentucky's would not – and that Dylan Moses would not get a tackle in that game. Now, it's possible that there was a stat broadcast error in there, because I did see a picture of Dylan Moses just draped all over a Kentucky ball carrier. So it's entirely possible that Dylan Moses had tackles that were attributed to someone else due to a stat broadcast error of some kind or whatever. But I watched portions of the game back. You watched the game back, and while neither of us looked at the game specifically and watched Dylan Moses on every snap to see if he got credited with a tackle, I think I speak for both of us when I say when we watched the game back, we didn't really notice Dylan Moses all that much. So neither of us can say definitively that Dylan Moses did not get a tackle in that game, or there wasn't a play or two that he should have been credited with one. He definitely didn't have the kind of performance that you would expect a player of his talent level to have against an offense like this one that really kind of is in his wheelhouse, right? As something that he should do pretty well. So having now watched the game back and just adding on to the narrative of Dylan Moses's season, what do you think of him either having zero tackles in a game like this one, or just in general not being a huge factor like he could be?
I do think he had one tackle. I just don't think that he had any more than that, and that's pretty much the same thing. But he's struggled all season. Now, guys, you got to realize some of that is Dylan Moses. A lot of that's Dylan Moses, but some of that is also just the way the game's scripted and the way that you know, the opposing offense ends up attacking the defense. You know, there are certain, you know, when you're trying to get, now granted, based off of this particular game, him just getting the one tackle or zero tackles, I mean, you know, I guess I'm kind of guessing there, but if I remember correctly, I think he got the one tackle. I think you're right with that picture, but either way, he just did not have a great performance. Now granted, you know, you look at a guy like Christian Harris, and Christian Harris was the one, you know, people's got to understand about the mic compared to the will. Linebackers in any 3-4 defense is, you know, you got a lot of scraping and filling going on as far as gap responsibility. The will linebacker is kept clean a lot more to make tackles compared to the mic, because the runs go into the play side. And so that the mic backer's got to kind of stack and shed against opposing offensive linemen. Kentucky's got a pretty good offensive line, a guy by the name of Drake Jackson, who's probably one of the best centers in college football. And that's why, you know, when I was kind of going back and watching some of it, which I haven't gone back and watched all of it or enough of it yet to make a definitive ruling one way or the other. But Drake Jackson, he always does a great job of getting to the second level from the very, from the portions of the game that I've watched so far where I've actually kept an eye on Drake Jackson in particular. He was doing a great job of getting to the second level. There was plenty of times he worked his way up to Dylan Moses. But what happens is when, you know, that play side, if you're talking about flow, the backside linebacker, which was Christian Harris, he was able to get a free flow to the football and make a ton of tackles. I think he had double digits, like 10 or 11 tackles, if I'm not mistaken. And so that happens. I wasn't overly surprised. Now, granted, here's the thing. I think that Dylan Moses is becoming kind of the unsung hero. I would definitely wouldn't put it that way, but he's making a bigger impact than people realize. And it doesn't necessarily come statistically. He's still going to get a lot of attention from opposing defenses. He's having to do a lot of the dirty work. Like I said, being that Mike, he's not really built to be a Mike. He should be playing that will spot like he's always played. He's not going to be, I understand he's 6'3", 240 pounds, but he's a lean 240 pounds. He's not typically the guy that you want with his closing speed and things like that. He's the guy that you want, you know, being that free flowing linebacker that can get sideline to sideline. Instead, he's getting mixed up with a lot of interior offensive linemen and trying to force things back to the will linebacker, you know, on cutbacks and things like that if possible. But he's not playing his football. Or even close to it. So I'm not sitting here saying, oh, you know, this is, you know, it's not telling the whole story, but to some degree I am, that there's aspects of this that are just a little bit different that people don't necessarily realize. The Dylan Moses that we used to see was playing a lot more will linebacker, and that's a different role compared to the Mike linebacker. But at the same time, he has not been particularly effective in coverage, at least not consistently. I like what some of the things that he did against Mississippi State in that area. Wasn't a ton off of as far as Kentucky, but it just doesn't seem like he's been. And there were some parts. He didn't have to play the coverage linebacker role a ton when Mack Wilson was there because Mack Wilson was such an effective coverage linebacker. But you just haven't really seen him take those kind of steps that you would hope. Higher defense, in my opinion, is still struggling with run fits. So I think it's a combination of a lot of different aspects, but there is some concern there. You still see all the mock drafts, and mock drafts mean nothing compared to, you know, what, but at the same time, just the height, weight, speed, overall ability of a guy like Dylan Moses, it's possible that he continues to have this kind of performance this season and still finds his way into the first round. I doubt it. But, you know, there are some things to be concerned about, and then there's some stuff that it's like, well, you know, that's more so understandable. But this one thing's for sure. Yeah, when you talk about the combination of Dylan Moses and Christian Harris, they have not been the caliber of tandem that I thought they would be coming into this season.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about the idea of Dylan Moses as kind of a glue guy, for lack of a better word, as someone who doesn't create the huge play, who doesn't create the big statistical impact, but kind of finds his way in other ways. And if that is the case, if that is in fact his role on this year's defense, he's the perfect guy for it. Because, I mean, look at the pieces around him. He's surrounded by young, talented players. He's surrounded by guys like Christian Harris and Will Anderson Jr. and basically everyone on the defensive line since LeBryan Ray has been injured for a few weeks and just barely kind of worked his way into this game. So most of the guys in front of him are of the Justin Aboigbe and Byron Young and DJ Bowles of talented sophomores who are still not green by any stretch, but finding their way is probably the way I put it. And then Malachi Moore in the slot, Jordan Battle and Daniel Wright behind him, DeMarco Helms as your dime guy, Josh Jobe at corner. There are a lot of young, talented pieces that really benefit from the presence of someone like Dylan Moses, who just knows what he's doing, who just sees what is happening and knows what to do about it. So there's if that is in fact where Alabama's defense needs him more than anywhere else, he's absolutely qualified to fit that role. It also kind of speaks to the tackle as the statistic. I think I did this rant a couple weeks ago. The tackle statistic is just garbage. It's not really useful for evaluating a defender's quality, really, because you don't really learn anything from the tackle statistic. Now, in this exact case, a person having zero tackles in a game like this, in a position like his, that's one of very, very few instances where you learn a little bit from the tackle statistic. But on the whole, I would be a little wary about using tackles as a legitimate measure of quality or insight in that regard. But I hadn't considered that role of Dylan Moses as a non-statistical producer. And as I kind of talked through it there with all the young talent around him, you definitely wouldn't have foreseen that role for him when he was a freshman and sophomore and balling out the way that he was. But is it going too far to say it might be the best thing for Alabama's defense for Dylan Moses to be that guy?
Well, it's just, you know, the I think he's much more effective at it than Christian Harris. And I think that's the two guys that you want on the field. I think that combination, you know, compared to a Shane Lee who's so limited athletically, or a, you know, Joshua McMillan who can do some good things from knowing what to do, but he's also limited athletically as well. You have a good tandem to some degree. And what we also got to remind ourselves about the Alabama's defense is that Dylan Moses and Christian Harris don't have any Jonathan Allens or Deron Payne's or Terrence Cody's, or, you know, some of these guys that are just so, or Williams even, that who are so dominant playing in front of them that they demand so much attention from the opposing offense. When you're having to worry about a combination of Jonathan Allen and Deron Payne, two first round picks playing on the same defense now there in Washington, but when they were playing in Alabama, you had multiple defenders that were just extremely tough to keep blocked. They commanded so much attention from all five of the offensive linemen that anybody that was playing behind them a lot more free reign. They didn't have to stack and shed as much. Their overall jobs were just a lot easier, to be quite honest with you. And so we have to keep that in mind as well. Don't get me wrong. Alabama has a very deep defensive line, and they have one of options there. But at the same time, they don't have anybody that you look at and say, he's going to just command so much attention as far as the offensive coordinator, the game plan coming in. He's going to be a wrecking ball, creating havoc to open things up for the off-ball linebacker. So that also plays into it as well. I think it's more of a combination of things, and that's why you don't hear Nick Saban really criticizing Dylan Moses. I don't think he's playing his best football. I really don't. I don't think this is everything can be attributed to something else. I think a lot of it has to do with Dylan Moses still recovering from that injury, still trying to get his bearings back, and he's just not playing as confidently. But there are other factors that are masking some of that and making it seem even worse, and I think that's something that we need to take into consideration.
Bama Pro Updates on Twitter will be thrilled to hear Emma just then a minute ago. The daycare is closed for Thanksgiving week, so Pickles podcast star Emma Hudson is back on her rightful throne. Yeah, I wish you could take the last like 5 minutes of this podcast and send it to the August versions of ourselves and convince us that this is the timeline that we would live in, that Dylan Moses is not the statistical monster and the best Alabama defensive performance of the season to date. That would just be mind-blowing to us, I think. But here we are. Emma, stop me if you have another thought on the defense you want to get out. But my last thought on the offense is I have this take, okay? And I don't like myself for having this take. I wish I didn't have this take, but I do. Jahlil Billingsley is the best tight end on this team, okay? And I love Miller Forrestall as a person. As a human being, I like Miller a lot. Whenever he is done playing football, he is going to be wildly successful in whatever he chooses to do. And he's a likable person. He's an intelligent person, and he's funny. I like Miller Forrestall. And honestly, like, when his playing career is over, he is absolutely the kind of dude you want to go have a few beers with. He's a good dude. I like him a lot. Jahlil Billingsley is the best tight end on this roster. Are you going to spend much energy telling me I'm wrong?
No. Okay. I'll say this. Major issues as far as run blocking ability. You know, he's by far the best receiving threat at the position and really a matchup nightmare. You know,
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think Jahlil Billingsley is a good enough receiver to challenge Miller in that regard.
Wait, what do you mean receiver?
As a pass catcher.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think he's the best pass catching tight end on the roster. I'm saying that I think from a run blocking.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I just think there was a lot left to be desired. I think he played, you know, he was in on somewhere in the mid-20s as far as run blocking snaps, and I just didn't think he performed that well in that area. But at the same time, you know, Miller Forrestall has never been a great run blocker either. I think he tries really hard, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot to like as far as his want to be a capable run blocker, but I just don't think he's been very good in that aspect. And, you know, that's Carl Tucker, right? You know, that's kind of why he's there. He had the drop against Kentucky. He played, you know, roughly, he didn't play a ton of snaps. I want to say he maybe played 20 or 25 or something like that. Okay. And, you know, he's a pretty good run blocker. But I think a combination of Carl Tucker and Jahlil Billingsley, as far as you might not have a complete tight end necessarily on the roster, but you got your run blocker, you got your elite receiver at the, not maybe not elite receiver yet at the position, but he certainly added a dynamic, a new wrinkle that is just going to be something else that opposing defenses have to deal with offense.
Yeah, I got you. I'm with it. So again, I don't like myself right now. I wish I didn't feel this way, but I do. I think Jahlil Billingsley is the best tight end on this roster. I've been trying to tell y'all about that dude on this podcast for months, and he gets his opportunity and he balls out. Three catches for like 70 something yards. So this is my moment of vindication.
You know what? You're not wrong. You have been completely, you know, team Billingsley for, you know, really, I mean, even since the offseason, even since early in the offseason, like after the Michigan game and everything, we saw a couple of catches or at least one catch that I can remember against Michigan. And I remember getting on the podcast soon after that and you talking about the future and you really hyping up Billingsley. And I kept thinking from the seniority factor with Miller Forrestall, from Carl Tucker, he hadn't had the level of impact that I thought he would. You know, I thought he would be just another Landon Dickerson, to be quite frank. I really did. I thought he was going to come in, kind of assume, you know, the starting role. There'd still be other tight ends involved, but he would be kind of the dominant guy and make a world of difference as far as, you know, his run blocking ability. And I thought he would be an underrated, valuable chess piece in the way that you could use him. And he would be an underrated receiver. And that just hadn't come to fruition, but he's still been an effective piece who has a role, even though it's very limited in Alabama's offense. But Jahlil Billingsley, moving forward, I think you're onto something. I think that he's going to really add a wrinkle. And you start talking about, you know, potentially, it's not a guarantee at all, but potentially getting Jalen Waddle back at some point, much later on in the season. You're talking about the way Devontae Smith has been playing, which is out of his mind. One thing I'll say about him very, very quickly, I know we got to wrap this thing up fast, but I think he's done everything that he's been possibly asked to do. He's covered every aspect of being an effective receiver for Alabama. Statistically, he's up there. But what he's shown me this year, you know, he's been a clutch factor receiver since his freshman year. You know, on the receiving end of that, you know, spin move against Vanderbilt from Tua Tagovailoa, whether it be the game-winning touchdown against Mississippi State from Jalen Hurts to keep the season alive, whether it be in the national championship on the second 26 for the 41-yard touchdown. Already had the clutch gene, but statistically last year led Alabama in a lot of receiving categories. But I thought a lot of that could be attributed to the fact that so many defenses put such a huge emphasis on Henry Ruggs and Jerry Jeudy. It was kind of like pick your poison. And I actually thought that Jalen Waddle was the third most respected receiver when it came to opposing defensive coordinators. And that left, you know, a lot of opportunities for Devontae Smith. But what this year has proven, and especially since Jalen Waddle has gone down with this injury, but prior to that as well, is he stepped up and become the guy that opposing defenses are trying to scheme against. And that is especially held true following that injury to Waddle. And he continues to dominate week in and week out. You have to give him a ton of credit. There's nothing left for him to prove as far as, you know, where he should stand in the rankings for top receivers in Alabama school history. He might not get the respect that he deserves. I think that if you probably even asked most Alabama fans just off the street, give me your top five receivers in Alabama school history, he might not even be on that list. He would probably be just outside that list. But for me, I think that even though he might not be as flashy and might not have the NFL career as some of these other guys, I still think that, you know, he is might be the most criminally underrated receiver in Alabama history and maybe even SEC history. Even though he gets a ton of respect, he's just not viewed in the same way that some of these other bigger name guys are. But you have to give him a ton of credit for what he's been able to do in Tuscaloosa.
Quick top five receivers in Alabama history. Richard Mullaney, Garrick Dieter, Will Oakley, Slade Bolden, and Sam Collins, obviously. I don't think that's up for debate.
Oh, man.
Need to get out of here. The thing about Devontae that stands out to me and why I think he's going to be incredibly valuable at the next level. He is constantly open. Like, you never see him forced to make a contested catch within maybe like 12 yards of the line of scrimmage. Now, when he's like going deep and it's a jump ball one-on-one type situation, yeah, those are contested catches and he's going up over somebody to get it. But when he's running a comeback or a slant or an in, it is constantly wide slap open. He's never having to like shake somebody off when they come over his shoulder trying to prevent him from getting a comebacker. Like, he's constantly just whipping people with his route running. And that is an undervalued skill when the data and everything tells us to value elusiveness and yards after the catch, which is all fine and good. It should be, but there are no yards after the catch if there is no catch. So got to get open. And Devontae does that better than probably anybody in college football right now.
Absolutely. All right. Well, that's going to do it for another episode of the Bama Beat podcast, brought to you by Wickles Pickles and Home Field Apparel. Brett, as always, I appreciate you hopping on here with me. I appreciate the listeners for listening in. We'll see you guys, or I guess we'll talk to you guys later this week.